time, same basic reasons as many West European countries such as France and just a little bit later, Great Britain. Jump to the 20th century. The re-entry of married women into the labor force of the 1950s and 1960s. Essentially the same phenomenon, same rates, same basic reasons, U.S. and Western Europe. The so-called sexual revolution of increased teenage sexual activity beginning around 1960 or perhaps a little bit before. Same patterns, U.S. and Western Europe. It's as though, again, because of mutual influence, shared origins, and ongoing participation in a similar kind of industrial and political society, you're talking about different versions of the same place, obviously. There's no full resolution to this civilizational discussion. You can make a good case either way, and any party to one side has to recognize there's some merit on the other. The point is, as we try to put the U.S. in world history, we've got to recognize there's some serious issues about what kind of categorization to use, what kind of civilizational framework makes most sense. And one final point on this, very quickly, the relationships don't necessarily remain constant. In the decades right after World War II, the U.S. and Western Europe undoubtedly converged increasingly. The U.S. Developed increasing welfare activities. Europeans toned down socialism. Europeans got rid of aristocracy and peasantry. Europeans began to face increasing immigration. Lots of parallels that made it likely that it was going to become increasingly logical to recognize they're part of the same civilizational package. But then in recent decades, increasing separation again, partly as the U.S. remains a great superpower, heavily militarized, and Western Europe reduces its commitment there. New attitudes, differentiations arise concerning things like the death penalty, concerning things like appropriate stances toward teenage sexual behavior. The dynamic can oscillate, and that complicates and vivifies key analytical issues as well. Final question. Relating to the question, is U.S. separate civilization but different? As the U.S. becomes more important in world affairs, later 19th century onward, does it exert a special mark on the rest of the world? Or is it largely following the dynamic prepared by larger Western interactions already? Again, a debate is possible, and there are points on both sides. But think about it. If we're going to make a case, there's no question that the U.S. exercises increasing power. Its role in World War I is enhanced further in its role in World War II, Cold War, only superpower. The events and incidents in which the U.S. influence on the rest of the world expands is an undeniably important part of contemporary world history. But the underlying question is, as it did this, as it did become more significant, was it doing anything special? Here are some candidates. And again, I wish I could debate you directly, and certainly it's not a subject that's easy to resolve. Here are some candidates. Europeans frequently argue that as the United States became more important in world affairs, beginning particularly with Woodrow Wilson after World War I, the U.S. displayed a combination of inexperience and moralistic naivete that contrasted with the more sober, realistic approach that Europeans themselves took. In other words, they saw the U.S. as recurrently more idealistic, more starry-eyed, more risky, actually, more dangerous, because they didn't recognize the sober realities of world affairs. They constantly thought, for example, that American values could be easily translated to other parts of the world. So as the U.S. becomes more important, this unrealism slash moralism becomes more important as well, differing from the world as it had previously operated under West European leadership more strictly. Some critics have urged, and I think this would particularly bear on World War II and after, that the United States displays an unusual penchant for high-tech approaches to military activities, delights in sophisticated weaponry, delights in long-distance bombardments in ways that go beyond what perhaps would be militarily desirable or necessary. Again, a controversial point may be worth undertaking. At some junctures, though I think the force of this one probably has faded by the 1980s, some analysts argued that as the United States became more important in world affairs, it became more interested than Western Europe was in promoting a destruction of colonialism and an encouragement to democracy. Maybe this would play, I think it's relevant for the 1950s and 60s, perhaps a little bit less so thereafter, an interesting element. And finally, and again, please, the list can be expanded. I'm only offering a few talking points. Finally, a real case for American influence in helping to shape world consumerism. The United States was not the origin of modern consumerist society. Western Europe was, as we've touched on previously. But the United States embraced consumerism increasingly in the 19th century. It had a huge national market, much larger than any individual European country, which helped develop the apparatus for the dissemination of consumerism. It did not have an aristocracy or some other traditional groups ready to criticize the shallowness of consumerism. There was a lot less opposition to consumerism in the U.S. than elsewhere. So by the 20th century, certainly, with the explosion of Hollywood, for example, as the world's movie capital, which had clearly been established by the second decade of the 20th century, the United States is prepared to play a cultural role, a popular cultural role, in world affairs different from that of the West more generally, and a distinctive, whether for good or for ill, a distinctive contribution to world affairs more generally. But again, finally, this approach needs to be balanced against a sense that as the United States became more potent in world affairs, it really picked up the neo-imperialist core mantle that Western Europe had already developed, as it tried to pick up the pieces of empire, for example, from the French in Vietnam, or pieces of British policy in the Middle East and Greece after World War II. The U.S., despite a different tradition in part, despite different rhetoric, was really behaving not as an outright imperialist, but as an imperialist legatee in ways that really are much more significant than any sort of special United States thrust. And the same certainly applies to core activities, where in its interest in obtaining access to cheap goods, in protecting the export opportunities of high-tech operations, along with basic foodstuffs, the United States behaves much as core societies have since the advent of the world economy. Again, a really tough, revealing debate in which historical traditions play against contemporary operations, in which the United States is separate as against the United States as part of a larger Western thrust, needs to be discussed very directly as we accomplish the essential goal, the unavoidable goal, of taking seriously how we approach American history from a world history context.
Lecture 33, Contemporary Democracy.
Our discussion today focuses on political change in the contemporary period of world history, and more specifically on the various surges and sometimes setbacks of political democracy. Two preliminaries. I need, first of all, to offer a definition of democracy. Nothing particularly sophisticated here. I view democracy as that system that allows lots of people, at least majorities of people, opportunities to vote for political candidates and political parties. There may be some exclusions. The United States, for example, is regarded as a democracy, even though it excludes quite a number of people who've been convicted of felonies, a particular feature of the American system of criminal justice. Voting is part of democracy, obviously, but so are opportunities for reasonable freedom of expression, opportunities for different candidates and different parties to compete in elections and to have enough freedom of expression to elicit or solicit support for their candidacies. Second preliminary involves the obvious relationship between my sub-theme, the rise of democracy, or the rise of democracy, and particular facets of American foreign policy. At various points in the 20th and 21st centuries, the United States has been a vigorous sponsor of democracy in other parts of the world. It has tried this recently, obviously, as one particular expression. And therefore, the topic today relates to aspects of American foreign policy, but I also don't want to get bogged down in a detailed assessment of that policy or be associated one way or another with the virtues or drawbacks of this policy. So the relationship is clear. It's not my main focus. The most obvious, the most indisputable aspect of our topic today is the fact of political change. As I mentioned in introducing the contemporary period in world history a few sessions back, almost no part of the world by the early 21st century had the same system of government as it had had a century before. There were obvious exceptions, including the United States, but political change was a fact of life for a variety of otherwise different regions. And this means more particularly that the dominant political forms of the early 20th century, which were empires and monarchies, gave way in most instances to change. Empires, of course, fell most obviously because they could not sustain themselves against the rising tide of nationalism and demands for national independence. This was the fate, quite obviously, of the great European colonial empires, but we also want to remember that Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire fell victim to these forces as multinational empires early in the 20th century, and later on, elements, at least, of the Russian Empire would also be peeled away. So empire no longer seemed a viable approach by the second part of the contemporary period of world history as it is thus far played out. The fall of monarchy is perhaps less self-evident. Obviously, the tide of revolution, one of the important phenomena of the contemporary period, worked against monarchy. All the revolutionary movements wanted to replace monarchies with some form of republic. Monarchy fell victim also to a more general sense that somehow the form was associated with an older system, with outdated policies, that the form was not supple enough or expressive enough to fit modern circumstances. And monarchy in some specific instances also fell victim to its very definite association with aristocratic social systems, agricultural rather than urban systems of economic and political expression. So with rare exceptions, monarchy also fell victim to a felt need for change. Of course, figurehead monarchies remained in some instances, and there were a few more active cases. There are vigorous monarchies in a few parts of the Middle East, in a few, although probably a smaller percentage of cases in sub-Saharan Africa, and in a couple of instances elsewhere. But in general, the dominant forms of the early 20th century, forms that had survived centuries of existence during the history of agricultural civilizations, these dominant forms fell by the wayside. Replacing them, if we look at the contemporary period of world history as a whole, replacing them were three or four major options, because the second point is that no absolutely uniform pattern of response emerged to the fact of political change. The old was out. How the new would be defined was a matter of contestation. One option, obviously, was democracy, and we're going to return to that momentarily. Democracy, as I've very crudely defined it already. But early on also, fascist totalitarian systems emerged. They are mainly a creature of the 1920s and 30s. They were extremely hard to dislodge. Only defeat in war really finally did the trick. But they were not sufficiently vigorous or popular enough to revive after their World War II defeat. But there's no question, in a number of parts of the world, fascist or at least semi-fascist alternatives seemed attractive, and some elements of this approach can be found even after World War II. Fascism appealed in societies where there were significant issues of national frustration, defeat in war, or appetites for more territory. Fascism emerged where there were pronounced, vigorous social divisions, with fascism serving as a popular cover for upper-class domination, but under new political labels, fascism obviously served as vehicles for new leadership ambitions, for new efforts to use modern methods of propaganda and intimidation to link peoples with this new principle of leadership. A second alternative, also usually called totalitarian in that it involved governments that sought to control most aspects of the society under them and also to eliminate all vigorous forms of political opposition. Totalitarian options also obviously emerged in societies that were seized by communist revolutions or conquered by communist regimes. Communism was not the same as fascism, though some similarities can be found, but it did coincide with fascism in this emphasis on strong central government control, coupled with significant efforts to appeal to popular support and to insist on active popular loyalty. A fourth form, we have democracy, fascist totalitarianism, communist totalitarianism. A fourth form shades off a bit from totalitarianism. The boundary lines are not always totally clear, but this involves a somewhat updated version of authoritarianism, where leaders or single political parties or, in many cases, military combinations will seize control, eliminate most effective political opposition, not, however, necessarily construct quite such a powerful central government apparatus as fascism or communism involved. Authoritarianism surfaced, again, in countries where social divisions ran deep and it was difficult to gain agreement on any single political or social system without the imposition of authoritarian controls. They surfaced in some cases in societies that were eager to modernize, but mistrustful, or at least the leaders mistrustful, of other mechanisms for doing so, where a top-down approach seemed essential. Authoritarianism was obviously, and is still, a significant political response to change in the contemporary world history period. World history's contemporary period began, as we've noted already, with World War I, and the aftermath of World War I initially, very briefly, seemed somewhat encouraging to possibilities for a spread of democracy to additional areas of the world beyond its then current home in Western society, both Europe and North America. The Mexican Revolution flirted with democratic systems and did install universal suffrage for the first time in Mexican history, but obviously fairly quickly the revolution turned to a reduction of political competition in favor of one-party rule. Democracy was established in Germany and Italy for the first time, although Germany had had approaches to it previously. Democracy was also established in most of the new regimes of East Central Europe, the regimes that had been carved out of the previous territory of the Russian and Austro-Hungarian empires. This initial democratic surge, obviously, went south fairly quickly. Most of the new regimes were incapable of sustaining democracy given the inexperience of their citizenry with democratic forms, given sharp social divisions, for example, in East Central Europe, sharp social divisions between landlords and peasants, such that landlords, as a means of trying to inhibit social unrest, supported authoritarian alternatives basically to keep peasants down. And as is well known, the only durable democracy to emerge from this East Central European zone in the interwar period was that of Czechoslovakia. Every other system crashed, including the democratic experiments in the new nation of Yugoslavia. Democratic systems were also briefly installed in Japan, an important development of the early 1920s, but there too they quickly fell victim to more authoritarian leadership and particularly the demands of military authorities. The surge of democracy was interesting. It suggested already that the success of democracies in some parts of the West provided a model that seemed logical to many new regimes in other parts of the world. There were also hints of democracy even in Sun Yat-sen's China, though here too they fell victim to landlord usurpation and civil war and ultimately invasion. So a flurry of interest, but obviously also the interwar period is dominated not really by the durable spread of democracy, but by its increasingly beleaguered stance, because the real winners from this first period of political change involved the rise of fascism in Italy and Central Europe, the rise of new authoritarian systems, some of them semi-fascist, in places like Brazil or Spain or East Central Europe, the rise of communism, of course, in Russia, the Soviet Union itself. Democracy even faltered in its home base of Western Europe, where the erosion of centrist parties, increasing social conflicts, increasing divisions over responses to the fascist and communist threats, paralyzed many democracies and caused it to become difficult for them to develop constructive responses to the major issues of the day. This was not a happy period for democracy, though, of course, it did survive and even demonstrated capacity for some regeneration in particular cases like the United States. The aftermath of the Second World War ushered in a more durable expansion of democracy beyond its previous concentration in North America and Western Europe, and I should also add Australia and New Zealand, clearly successful cases of democratic installation during the early 20th century. Particularly noteworthy, of course, was the establishment of democracy in Western Germany and in Italy, where Allied occupation encouraged a political change that, it has to be recognized, took surprisingly successful route given the experience of the interwar period. Obviously, the defeat of fascism removed one alternative, at least in these societies, and democracy began to flourish and has done so ever since in these cases. Democracy was also established in Japan under American leadership, and here too it took successful root. Japanese democracy has operated somewhat differently from Western democracies at key points. During much of the post-World War II period, Japan was dominated by a single liberal democratic party, and new leadership came more from struggles and competitions within the party than from inter-party competition, but there was such competition, and it had reasonable freedom of expression and political contest. Japan has to count as one of the new success stories also. And, of course, soon after World War II, a huge gain for democracy came in the establishment of the democratic government in newly independent India. India, obviously, utilized its experience under the British, even though the British had not given them full democracy. India benefited from leadership emanating from Gandhi, Nehru, and others who were committed to democratic systems. Older Indian traditions, for example, the regional concentrations of Indian politics, which inhibited against the construction of too centralized a state. Earlier traditions also of government through advice councils and this sort of thing may also have encouraged Indian democracy. But the fact was that India stood out from 1947 onward as being the world's largest and ultimately one of the world's most successful democratic systems. In the main, however, the decades immediately after World War II were again not particularly friendly to democratic systems. Many of the new nations established in the wake of decolonization initially launched themselves as democracies. Again, the popularity, the respectability of this form and its pleasingness in Western eyes contributed strongly to this initial impulse. But equally obviously, democratic systems survived in very few of the new nations. India here stood out as a really interesting as well as a really significant exception. New nations issues, the lack of abundant experienced leadership, the lack of citizen experience with democracy itself, disputes over boundaries, disputes over social systems, internal social strife, all of these conditions, which were already familiar from New Nation's experience in Latin America, all these conditions tended to yield fairly quick replacement of initial democratic experiments with usually authoritarian leadership, sometimes with vaguely fascist trappings. Latin America in post-war decades also tended to emphasize great variety and oscillation. But Latin America also tended to emphasize either new style popular authoritarian systems like Peronism in Argentina, or military leadership equally bent on inhibiting political opposition and maintaining strong central authority. Democracy, again, did not seem to flourish. And the expansion of the communist world, not only through Russia's move into East Central Europe, but through revolution in China and then in Vietnam and communist seizure of North Korea, added new regions to the list of clearly non-democratic alternatives. Beginning in the 1970s, however, a new current can be discerned that seems to lead fairly directly to the present-day pattern of unusually extensive hold of democratic systems in the world at large. The 1970s saw first the establishment of democratic systems in the southern fringes of Europe, Spain, Portugal, and Greece, where monarchies and or authoritarian systems had previously flourished. Spain, of course, did install a newly vigorous monarchy, but one that was committed to effective democratic rule. Later in the 1970s, the really historic shift of Latin America to democratic forms began, a shift that would extend from the late 70s into the 1990s, and would see virtually every Latin American country except Cuba embrace democratic systems with a considerable degree of genuineness and some signs, at least, of real durability. So authoritarian regimes fell away. By the 1990s, Mexico's one-party system fell away to more widespread political competition and open political expression. This was a truly important surge. Following this first flush of new democracy in some parts of the world, the 1980s saw democracies installed in a number of places in East and Southeast Asia, usually on the heels of popular agitation. So democratic or more democratic systems developed in South Korea and Taiwan, and ultimately in the Philippines. Democratic systems also, obviously, and this was a third important regional extension, democratic systems also began to develop between the mid-1980s and the early 1990s in most parts of what had been the former Soviet Empire. Gorbachev's decision in 1985 to open Russia itself to new levels of political discussion and competition was not initially intended to install a multi-party democratic system, but it certainly began to lead in that direction. And then the dismantlement of the Soviet Empire led to a number of installations of democracies, either fairly peacefully or with only modest amounts of violence, in almost all of the string of former Soviet or Soviet-dominated territory in East Central Europe, in some other parts of the former Soviet Empire as well. The 1990s, continuing this surge, saw the expansion of democracy in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Most African countries remained one-party rule or authoritarian, but over 20 regimes during the 1990s did shift to democracy, and the movement seemed to continue into the 21st century. Crucial were the establishment of democracy in Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation, and, of course, the dismantling of apartheid and the establishment of a successful democratic political system in South Africa. Again, the sub-Saharan African map remains politically divided, but the trend was reasonably clear.